you have to be okay with saying, we don't know what we don't know. And so you go in with curiosity, with humility, and with the willingness to sometimes fall flat on your face. And if that's the case, you get up, you look at what you learned, and you move on. To me, that's the only way forward.
Steven is one of my good friends of this industry and one of the smartest people when it comes to this space. Kiehl's is up over 100% year over year in EMV, and it's easy to see why. Remember, if you enjoyed today's show, be a friend, tell a friend. Thanks, guys.
Explore the minds and marketing strategies behind today's winning brands and businesses. Tap into the power of the creator economy with Earned by Creator IQ. Here's Connor Begley.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to Earned. Today, I've got Steven Wahlberg, the SVP of Global Brand Engagement and Communications at Kiehl's on the show. Welcome to the show, Steven.
Hey, Connor. Happy to be here.
And Steven and I go way back. I think we've been in communication for like 7 years now. Like, it's something really long.
Way longer than that. You just don't want to age us, which I...
That's true.
It's been way longer, more than 10 years.
Yeah. Well, speaking of aging us, I'm feeling aged out. I haven't tried Threads yet. And, you know, we're talking pre-show about it. And obviously it's buzzing. I've been on vacation. I just got back yesterday, so I haven't gotten to play around with it. I'm curious, have you gotten to play around with it yet? Do you have any perspective? I think it's hit 100 million users within like 48 hours or some crazy number. Tell me about it.
I have definitely downloaded it and started playing with it. The brand that I work for, Kiehl's, is already on it. It's funny because I was hoping to be one of the early adopters, and Meta obviously makes it easy for you to download and link to your Instagram account. And then on your Instagram, as you probably know, right under your profile name, you have a number, and that number is where you line up in the download queue of the app. So are you number one? Are you number two? I think I'm like number 17 million. I guess I was not one of the early adopters, but have been playing with it. And I will say I was never on Twitter much. I'm just more of a visual person. So I've gravitated more towards Instagram, TikTok, et cetera. But I do have to say that in the early days of Threads, it's quite fun to navigate. For now, we're in the very early days. It seems like a very inoffensive, fun, lighthearted environment. I'm loving seeing brands banter between one another, oftentimes brands that are competitors, again, in a very lighthearted way. And I'm missing a few things, like the ability to search topics through hashtags or otherwise.
Yep.
That's coming down the line. But for now, it's just important, I think, as a marketer to be on it. Number one, test and learn. There's no playbook right now, so sort of everything's fair game. But I think the good news is that all of the people who've downloaded it, or certainly the ones that I have visibility to right now, nobody is using it in sort of foul ways. And it's pretty positive. I think people are tired of the nastiness that social media can bring. It's an interesting space to watch.
I mean, I think that's a big part of the reason that people have been attracted to TikTok, right? Is like, I've often heard that the different social platforms are tied to emotions, right? So Instagram is often like jealousy, right? Like, I want that. And I think TikTok is like joy, right? Twitter is often associated with anger.
Yes.
And I know that Adam, the CEO of Instagram, said, like, we are going to be aggressively moderating anger, hate, all this kind of stuff to make it a fun place to be. So it's interesting that you've had that same observation.
It's the very early days, Connor. So, but the good news is in the last 10 days, there hasn't been one post that I've come across that had me thinking like, oh God, this is going to go south. So it's quite funny. I think right now people are having fun with it. So you're seeing a lot of memes. You're seeing a lot of stuff like that. I do get disappointed when I see people, Instagram, like people who have, or brands who have Instagram accounts and who literally copy paste the content on Threads. And I'm like, all right, well, like, could you be a little more original? But anyway, easy to say, right? But we'll see how it pans out.
Yeah, I think the capacity, I mean, just from a content creation perspective, it's like daunting to imagine being a brand in today's world where it's like you've got X number of platforms. Within each platform, you have multiple channel types, right? You've got Reels, Stories, Feed on Instagram. You've got Shorts, long form on YouTube. I can understand, right? It's like, I only have so much capacity to create unique stuff for each channel, but yeah, I don't know how you navigate that. It seems tough.
Yeah. You have to prioritize based on who your communities are, basically. So, and what their areas of interest are and where they are, right? Who are the people that you want to engage with and where are they and how do you engage with them? That's where it all starts, right?
Totally. Let's take a step back. I want to talk about you a little bit, right? So kind of hop straight in there. And I think your heritage is actually really fitting in terms of where you grew up and, you know, who your parents are. So your mom was a country singer, and then your dad was a sound engineer from France that moved to Nashville and met your mother there. Is that correct?
That's correct. So she wasn't a country singer, but she was a singer. Yes.
Oh, okay. Okay.
You did your research well. Yes.
Well, tell us a little bit about your life, right? So you've been doing this for 20 years across some of the best brands in the world. I'd love to know, just give us a background. Tell us who you are.
Yeah. Listen, I'm exactly what you said. I'm half French, half American, was conceived in Nashville, as far as I know, and born in France and grew up in France right outside of Paris and lived there for 27 years and then always had that American dream, right? Having an American mom, speaking English from my first days of being able to speak. And so I had that American dream and really more that New York dream, actually, from having visited New York as a kid. I must have been 18 or something. And I was like, oh God, one day I'm definitely going to live there. And so I was lucky to join a global company called L'Oréal. Right out of college, I was 20 or 21 years old and started with them out of college in Paris at the luxury division and did three jobs before they eventually granted my wish of a job in New York for Maybelline as the head of global comms at the time. So that's it. So it's funny, my partner, Julian, often refers to me, when he explains me to people, he says, yeah, you with Steven, you've got sort of the mix of fried chicken meets foie gras. And I think that's a good metaphor. You know, I've really got both sides in me, that kind of like the fried food. If it ain't fried, it ain't food. And I really enjoy all of that. And then my French, I guess, more Parisian upbringing, which comes with me liking things like foie gras and certain brands that I wear and the way I hold a knife and a fork and all of that. So I'm a kind of a weird hybrid, like most people who are bicultural, I guess, right? You never fully fit in one country or the other. One of my friends once said, she's actually third British, third Italian, third French. And she once confided in me, she said, the sense of belonging is tough. You don't really know, like, you're spread amongst, but at the end of the day, honestly, Connor, it's obviously one of the greatest privileges in life to have those two cultures and languages and everything like that. But it can be funny sometimes, for sure. But I was always very lucky that I knew from a super young age what I wanted to do. And that was luxury. And that was comms. At the time, we called it PR. And I did a couple of internships around 15 or 16, thanks to family connections. And I was an intern at Van Cleef & Arpels in the comms department, so high jewelry. And this was way before social and all that stuff, but I loved it. And I thought, that's what I want to do. Not many people know from a young age what they want to do, and I was one of those people. So I feel very, very lucky that way, for sure.
Yeah, I'm curious, in between, right? So you started at L'Oréal, you were there for quite a while, and then spent time at Bulgari and Calvin, right on the fashion and luxury side of things, and then came back to beauty and to L'Oréal. What was it that attracted you back? What was your experience like on the fashion side of things? And then what brought you back to the beauty industry?
Right. I think let's start with, why did I leave L'Oréal? What I was thinking at the time was, wow, they've taken such good care of me. I've had amazing jobs, an amazing trajectory here. But I was, 38, I guess, at the time. And I thought, I've only ever worked at one company in my entire life. And something in me told me that I just had to go and work somewhere else and prove to myself that I could.
Mm-hmm.
So I left in really good terms. I wasn't mad at them at all. And so when the opportunity came for Bulgari, that was LVMH. It was a job in Rome. So back to Europe from where I had been gone for quite a few years. closer to my dad, my partner closer to his family, for him. I thought this is something new. And I did enjoy my internship at Van Cleef & Cartier, the craftsmanship, the luxury, and all of that stuff. So I was like, that sounds pretty amazing. And so I did that for almost, I guess, 18 months, couple of years, and then really wanted to come back to New York so badly and got that amazing opportunity at Calvin Klein. And then that was at a time when the world exploded with COVID. I think we all went through that. And that was a really, really trying time. And I had to go through furloughs and layoffs and all of that, which was pretty traumatizing, as it was for everyone, really, who had a job and people who lost their jobs, et cetera. And so when I found myself without a job for the first time in my life, I thought to myself, what is most important to me now? I'm 40. Was 40 years old, I guess, 41. I said, what is important to me? What's the first thing that I need after having gone through all of this and COVID? And the one word that kept coming back was familiarity, something that's familiar to me. It was not, the first word wasn't, oh, I need something super luxurious or super different or super challenging. Mm-hmm. I wanted something that brought comfort and a level of something familiar and somewhere where I could go back in or arrive into and not have to spend 6 to 8 months learning who the key players were, learning the processes, feeling like you're not adding value yet. I also thought to myself, with the lesson of COVID, I want to work somewhere that's going to be recession proof, mm-hmm. crisis proof, if that makes sense. Not that any company is never going to face crisis. Of course they are. But and then the opportunity came around to go back to L'Oreal on the one brand that I was and continue to be an actual user of and a super loyal user of. And that brand is Kiehl's. And I've been using that brand since the company acquired it in 2000 or 2001. So the stars aligned. And I thought to myself, I went out, I experienced jewelry, watches, hotels, et cetera. At Bulgari in Rome, I got a piece of pop culture and apparel, et cetera, at Calvin Klein. And I'm very thankful for that. No regrets, just gratefulness. But now I get to go home in a way and work on a brand that is really, really, really dear to me. So that was my train of thought. And also, I think, too, the other two things is, having worked for essentially big, large corporations, the two things that were important to me, in addition to like knowing how things work, et cetera, I wanted to go back to a place for whom diversity was very important. And I remember when I started at Maybelline in 2007 in New York, remember this was 2007 and we were the global team at the time of about, I don't know, 60, 70 people. And I had counted 16 different nationalities on our floor. And that's something that to this day I remember and cherish. And those are the environments in which I really thrive. So diversity, and of course the innovation piece, right? I mean, L'Oreal is a very innovative company and they're always pushing you to go to the next frontier and testing the new platforms and all of that stuff. So that's something that I didn't necessarily find that level of innovation elsewhere. So those are the three things that were important for me.
Yeah, I mean, it makes a ton of sense. I think specifically given that kind of period of time, there was so much uncertainty about what was going on. And I think obviously L'Oreal's been around for more than a couple of years, right? I think they've weathered more than a few storms. Also, it's remarkable, by the way, I didn't realize you were so young. Not that you don't look it, but I think just looking at your background, it speaks like you would have an extra 5 to 10 years of experience at least. So congrats on that. Super impressive.
Well, thank you. I don't feel that young anymore. I'm 44. So, and now I'm seeing, no, but it's so funny because you start seeing people getting to the level of job that you have in other brands, whether it's at L'Oreal or other companies. And suddenly they're like 30, early 30s, late 20s, maybe sometimes. And I'm like, God, wow, I'm getting old. I need to stay relevant. And I'm doing everything to make sure I remain relevant. No, but seriously, you start thinking about those things. But then I have to remind myself, I'm like, yo, Steven, remember how old you were when you were given that opportunity to manage global comms for Maybelline in 2007? And I was 27 years old at the time. It was a very small team and all of that, but still, you definitely start paying attention to age and all that stuff in weird ways. But anyway, it's the human in us, right?
Absolutely. I shit you not. I was sitting there this morning in bed, and I don't know why this hit me, but I was like, so I'm 36. And I was like, I'm 4 years from 40. Like, that's really close. Like, I was thinking about that this morning. I don't think about this very often, but yeah, age is a funny thing.
Yeah. Enjoy those 4 years. Enjoy those 4 years thoroughly.
Well, since we're talking with such a veteran here, let's talk about how things have changed.
And now you're making me sound like I'm 90 years old. I'm a veteran. Okay. Great. Thank you.
Oh, man. So
relax yourself.
No, but seriously, when you first joined, right? So you joined, I mean, not again, we're not too dissimilar in age, but when you first started, digital was a new thing, right? The internet was a new thing. And I would imagine from a PR and comms perspective, it was really more about managing like magazines, TV relationships, right? People weren't really worried about like dot-coms or influencers or whatever. Mm-hmm. I'm curious, how have you seen that process change over time? Number one. And number two, now, like, is it like 90% digital, 10% physical? Like, how much do you still spend time on the more traditional kind of channels at all as an organization?
So I'll start with the first question. At the end of the day, I think you just have to be where people are, right? Where people go for their news, for their entertainment, for their banter. And a very important shift started happening in the early 2000s, right around 2007, 8, 9, when Facebook started and then Instagram. And we saw and we were a part of, as consumers, that shift to social. And so as we saw these users starting amassing followings and then monetizing, I don't think brands had any other choice but to lean in, right? So then it was all about how exactly do you lean in? And at the time, I remember there were several options when you looked at creators, and they were called influencers, right? Back in the day, we called them bloggers and influencers before we even used the word creator. But so did you spray and pray? Did you seed? Did you send them products? That was option one. Did you pay and tell influencers what you wanted them to say to their audiences about your brand and your product? Or did you want to partner with them and co-create and co-build, right? And that's something that I found to be more effective because I've tried it all, obviously, and I like that better. And I think I just find it more authentic. And I remember back when we signed, it was a Maybelline, and we signed New York Fashion Week, we were the main makeup sponsor for that. So I remember being backstage and we had created an account on Twitter called MNY Insider. And that was me in the beginning tweeting backstage, you know, the behind the scenes. And then that moved to Instagram and all of that. But it's so important to be hands-on and testing the platforms and being where people are, you know. And then, of course, it turned to Instagram and TikTok, and we tried Be Real. I tried Be Real on Kiehl's, actually. It didn't work out. It's okay. You try it. And then there was Clubhouse during COVID. We didn't go on it, but it didn't do what it was meant to do. But again, you have to have the curiosity to go on there and test it. And then, of course, TikTok. And TikTok made me buy it. I mean, we literally have kids coming to stores, actual physical stores, because we're a retail brand, right? And they'll come in and they say, I want this rare earth mask. And the skin pro in our store would be like, well, how did you find out about it? Oh, I saw it on TikTok. So it's an actual thing. So again, you just have to be where people are. And if they're on social, then that's where you need to be. And to answer your second question, is it 90% digital, 10% press? I think press still has an important role to play. Be a journalist is one of the oldest professions, and it's a very serious profession. And there are still people, believe it or not, who still read editorial work. And I'm one of them. And so, you know, when a brand or a company has something strategic to say, you know, you work with these, with the trades, you work with the agenda setting publications out there. We, of course, still work with the long leads, the short leads. I think they actually have, in my opinion, a more important role to play for luxury brands because they carry sort of the image, the aspirational side of things that you don't necessarily always get with all levels of creators. I don't have a specific number to give you how much time. Of course, I'd be crazy to tell you Otherwise, then the majority of the time is spent with online. But then it varies from one country to the other, from one region to the other. I mean, there's some countries in Europe where magazines are still more of a thing, where television is actually still more of a thing, too. Here in the US, we talk about streamers and social, paid social and all that stuff. But in Europe, there's television still holds true for them, and print press to a certain degree as well. So it kind of varies from one country to the other.
Yeah. No, I mean, I think press is frankly, press often is digital as well, right? So it's a mixture of both digital and physical.
Absolutely.
I think on the TikTok made me buy it side of things, obviously, at least within our data, we're tracking CeraVe, La Roche-Posay within L'Oreal, who are just absolutely on fire. I think La Roche is now our number one skincare brand globally, and CeraVe is a top 10. Have you seen an acceleration within L'Oreal in terms of their focus on both influencers, TikTok, like all those channels?
100%. Data speaks, right? And so you do these tests and you see what it does to your business, and you're able to acquire new customers, younger customers who are going to help future-proof your brand. And so, of course, you lean in, right? And so for sure, the company is investing more in that. And that's absolutely the right thing to do. We've had some successful campaigns as well with Kiehl's in the SAPMENA region and some in the US as well. So it's definitely something that is very, very relevant for us, for most brands, I think. I'm not going to speak for other brands, obviously, and other companies, but it's the natural evolution of things for sure.
Well, it's funny, it feels natural now, but I think when you leaned in really early, I mean, again, we've known each other for so long and there weren't a lot of leaders leaning in around that time. So it feels natural that that's occurring today, but like it wasn't natural 10 years ago.
That's true. But I think you have to be okay with saying, we don't know what we don't know. And so you go in with curiosity, with humility, and with the willingness to sometimes fall flat on your face. And if that's the case, you get up, you look at what you learned, and you move on. But I mean, to me, it's that's the only way forward. Fear cannot get in the way. You have to test. And so it's the same thing with Threads. It didn't take us 2 seconds to get on Threads. We're like, well, it's, first of all, it's Meta. We're on Instagram. Obviously, we advertise with them. And you do so, of course, you do some due diligence. You play with it a little on a personal level. But then you jump on it and you, as a brand, and you start seeing if it works for you, if it makes sense. And if it doesn't, then it doesn't. Then you move to the next. But you have to be where culture is. You can't just sit, you can't be an observer. You can't sit back in a chair and just watch the world go by. You have to be a part of it. So, but it comes with risks, but they should be measured risks, right? You're not going to go in there. First of all, right now, Thread isn't monetizing, right? So it's an organic play. Mm-hmm. So just get in there. If you have a community manager, get in there, play with it, have fun, learn what's going on. These are the early days. It's not that complicated. Just get in there.
Well, you're an earlier mover than me. Like I said, I've been on vacation, so I haven't downloaded Threads yet.
That's your only excuse, Connor.
I know.
It'd be like, what?
And again, you said you're like, oh, I'm 17 million. They got 30 million downloads in the first 24 hours. So you were there in the first 24 hours. That's pretty good. That's probably the first like 12 hours. So
yeah, maybe. Okay. I'll take the credit. Fine. Thanks.
So one of the areas I think you have a lot of unique insight into is kind of this idea of global marketing, right? So marketing from a global lens and perspective. Mm-hmm. And I think the other thing that I think is unique about you, right, is you also speak multiple languages, which I think helps, right? Translating through French or Spanish, whatever. Mm-hmm. So I'm curious for you, and this kind of ties into the idea of risk. Other cultures are different, right? They have different jokes. They have different mannerisms. They have different styles. They have different preferences.
Yeah.
How do you go about kind of navigating those differences as an organization and understanding all of those, right? Is it all outsourced, or how do you manage so many unique cultures as a business?
That's a really good question. Listen, Kiehl's is a global brand. We're present in over 60 countries across the continents. The one I think that where it all starts is you have to have a very strong foundation for your brand in terms of just knowing who you are as a brand, what you stand for, what your purpose is, what your values are, and who your tribes are. And then you go down into sort of like how that manifests visually, how that manifests from a tone of voice perspective. So all of your truths, if you will, which those are going to be a common denominator for all of the markets in which you operate. And with that, you create a frame and you make it very digestible for your markets. Then you have to workshop that with them, or certainly that's been our strategy with my team. You make sure that it's crystal clear to them. You make sure they understand it. You have to take in their questions, their challenges to fine tune what you assume is going to be your truth or your brand's truth internationally. You provide that frame, and then you have to let the countries do what they know how to do best, which is activate with their customers or potential customers in mind, knowing what they know about those cohorts. But again, with that frame in mind, and I think you mentioned earlier humor, and I think humor is a really good example. I see humor as a big new rising category within our marketing and even creator space. I heard this in Cannes at the Cannes Lions a few weeks ago. 90% of consumers say they want brands to use humor, but only 20% of brands do.
Mm-hmm.
So far, I've noted a very drastic acceleration in the last few months in our space, in the beauty space, and we've leaned in, and other brands have leaned in as well. But humor is something that is very, very local.
Mm.
And something that can be funny to us here in New York as Americans, as we're seeing something, a fun creator on Instagram or on TikTok or whatever the case may be, that's not necessarily going to resonate in Spain or in China or in Australia the same way. There's so many nuances there. So again, that's where you go back to your frame. So if you're talking about humor, how can you be a little bit more specific? What are the underpinnings of that humor that makes it heels? Is it a rawness about it? Is it a certain form of sarcasm? Is it a certain form of, I don't know, like I'm kind of making things up here to illustrate my purpose. But then you go and you tell markets like, okay, these are the criteria. Now go and work your magic. And then we work so, so closely with all of our markets. So keeping that dialogue open is so critical. And then they will be fast to come back and tell us when they feel something doesn't work or isn't valid for them. And so then we evolve, we pivot. And that's how I think that's been my recipe for working with markets. Never forgetting that as a global team, we are here to serve the markets. We service them. At the end of the day, the bottom line, selling the products, that's what they do. I don't get paid if markets don't activate successfully and sell our products, right? So I'm here to, of course, provide them with a vision and a strategy, but that strategy is not set in stone, and they are part of, they challenge it, they add to it, and it's a constant exchange. But they are my clients, if you will. And then their client is the person who buys Kiehl's and who pays the rents, basically, for all of us, right? You have to have utmost respect for that, I think.
Totally. Yeah, that humor concept is fascinating. I had never really, obviously, I observe it, right? I think you see it. I think it really started to emerge on, well, Twitter to an extent, and then TikTok as well, like in the comments, right? Like you'd see brands come in and make funny comments. And
yeah.
And you mentioned it on Threads, right? Where they're kind of having fun with each other, making fun of each other, interacting, et cetera. And the problem with that, or not the problem, but the hard part about it is like humor has edge, right? Humor, to be funny, you have to, you know, take some risk. And that's hard to do. It's hard to have the license to do that and to walk the line on what could possibly offend somebody or make somebody unhappy. Yeah, it's a really interesting problem. I hadn't thought about it a lot, that discrepancy between desire and reality.
Yeah, no, 100%. But I think people want to be entertained now. We're coming from such a dark place geopolitically and with COVID and all of that stuff. And I really got that vibe coming out of the Cannes Lions 2 weeks ago. you really get that sense that people want, they want positivity. They want to be entertained. They want to laugh. Of course, they want to be informed. Of course, they want to have value added to their lives and all of that. But I'm really excited to see that. I think we're hopefully coming out of a bit of a dark time and a dark zone to a moment in which this new generation, but not only this new generation, just want more lighthearted, more, yeah, and more humor. And to your point, yeah, there are risks associated with that, but there are risks when you work with creators and influencers, right? You have to learn how to relinquish control. And that's one of the hardest things when you're on the brand side, because you want to control the narrative. That's the default state that we are all in as marketers working on the brand side. And I think what you're taught through the years of experience and with the ever-evolving world and the ecosystem of creators, all of that stuff, and consumers, is that you can't control the narrative. Like, and you have to learn how to relinquish control. And sometimes and oftentimes it's when you relinquish control that you get the best piece of content that's going to go viral or that's going to be remembered. And that's cool.
100%. You know, it's funny. We're like internally at our company talking about like, how do we lean into this concept? It's like all of our content is created by us, right? Other than the podcast, right? The podcast, this is you, right? We're learning from you. But I think it's hard to let go of that control. So I think on that idea of fun, right? So coming out of dark times and like wanting positivity, et cetera. I think what I've really observed about you and your kind of leadership style is this, I think that's you, right? I think you have this positive energy, this humor, et cetera, that I think attracts people to want to work with you. And you've worked on large teams, right? Teams 50 plus, 75 yeah. plus, whatever.
Yeah.
And where I think that's really interesting in terms of contrast is in one of your interviews, you mentioned that your biggest flaw is also this desire to be well-liked, right? This desire to have people like you, which frankly is very similar to my own, right? Like, I think it's very similar. That's probably one of my biggest flaws. It just makes, and the outcome of that is it makes having conversations, difficult conversations, I'm just not that effective at it, right? Like being, because you don't want to make them feel bad, et cetera. So I'm curious, how do you find that balance personally? And this is a question as much for me as it is for everybody else, because that's something that I struggle with, right? I'm curious what your approach is there.
Yeah, I will be honest in saying that I'm still working on that whole, I want to be liked by everyone. And I think what I've hopefully been successful at implementing, if that's even the right word, is I think I've moved from I need to be liked by everyone to I want to make sure that no one feels let down by me. And that's a bit of a different statement, meaning I want to make sure everyone on my team knows that I have their back and that I'm going to make sure they have the best working conditions, that they get access to trainings, development, all of that stuff. I don't want anyone to tell me or to look back and say, well, you didn't do anything for me. You didn't help me. You didn't sit down with me when I needed advice or that kind of stuff. So that I will remain very strict with myself, and that's a non-negotiable. But now, is everyone going to want to be my friend? No. Is everyone going to think I'm the funniest person they've ever met or the best leader or the best marketer or whatever? No. And I'm sort of getting okay with that. And it's funny, I'll give you an example, and I kid around it with my current team, who I really, really, really adore. I have to say, I have a really, really cool team right now. And I've noticed that they go out for drinks like really often together. And I've got a few expats who are, my head of social comes from the UK. And so she's arrived a year ago with her husband and their 2-year-old daughter. And we've got a pretty cool team, multicultural and people from different places. And so I see, because I follow some of them, and we follow or mutually follow each other on Instagram, TikTok, whatever. And sometimes they'll just flat out tell me like, hey, we're going out for drinks or whatever. And I'm like, where's my invite? Like, why am I not part of that? And so I'm like, oh my God, I'm not cool enough for them to want me to come. I could at least foot the bill.
Yeah.
You know, and pay for the drinks.
Yeah.
But that's where I have to be like, well, I'm a team leader, and maybe they want to go and talk about stuff that's not a conversation that they want me to be a part of, as cool as I try to be or want to be or whatever. So now I actually joke about it openly with them. And I tell them, I'm like, oh, another drink I'm not invited to. Great. And then, of course, I organize things with them and whatever. But so it's, yeah, it's funny. But I definitely don't want anybody to ever say, like, he hasn't done enough for me, or he let me down. Like, that would kill me. That I would not like.
Yeah, I love that flip.
Have you made progress on that?
No, I haven't. Now, I'm sure I have a little bit, but I think it's a really interesting problem, right? I think that leadership is isolating, right? To be the leader is isolating. And, you know, you don't get invited on all the inside jokes. You don't get invited to all the parties, right? You don't know about all the, you know, rumors and what's going on. And, you know, you're forced to make decisions that are in the best interest of the business, but not necessarily in the best interest of your relationships with those people. And that's really challenging, right?
Yeah.
And there's a certain degree of like, is that even what I want? Is that important to me, right? What is important? And I think there's a lot of people that choose, no, that's not important to me, right? It's not important to be the leader because I don't want to have to do that. And so I think it's something that I still think about and I still struggle with, like, how much of that do I actually want? I'm not sure. So yeah, I'm still thinking about it, but I like your approach, which is like, I don't want to let people down. I want to do everything I can, right?
That's right.
Yeah. Well, I don't want to switch. I was going to switch and do a fun end of show question, but such a serious topic, not such a serious thread to follow. Well, let's do it. Let's do one fun end of show question.
Yeah.
So we'll break the tension here. So obviously your mother was a singer, professional singer, and your dad was involved in the musics. Did you ever consider becoming a professional music artist? Or any other artist for that matter?
The answer is a straight up no. No. And here's the main reason. I saw the struggles.
Yeah.
1 month you have clients and money, or you're selling records or whatever, and the next month you don't. And so stability is very important for me. So for that reason, sometimes I fancied actually being a talk show host, kind of like what you are right now. But yeah, that chip has sailed for me. But yeah, no, show business, I don't think that would have worked for me.
I don't think that ship has sailed. You're still young. You got a lot of time.
Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, no, I think it's funny how you can kind of go one of two directions. Either you can go the exact same path as your parents, or you can go the complete opposite. And I think it's like my parents, both from the time that I was born till the time that they retired, worked at the same places the whole time, right? And so for me, I looked at that and said, well, that's not what I want, right? I want some risk. I'm going to try new things. Ironically, I've been at Tribe/Creator IQ now for like 12 years. So I guess I'm following the same path.
I know. Yeah, but you've evolved your business so much though, and diversified it and everything. So you've certainly not been bored or doing the same thing for 12 years.
No, not at all.
Not from where I sit anyway.
Well, Stephen, I really appreciate you taking out the time and appreciate your friendship, and excited to see what you guys do with Kiehl's. Loving to see the progress already that you're making. And thanks for taking the time today.
Thank you so much, Connor. This was my honor to be on this show, and look forward to seeing you soon at one of your famous hangouts, industry hangouts. They're always a lot of fun.
For sure. All right. Bye, Stephen.
All right. Bye, Connor. Thanks.
Be a friend, tell a friend, and subscribe. Earned by Creator IQ. Creator IQ is your all-in-one solution to grow, manage, scale, and measure your influencer marketing program. Ready to unlock the power of the creator economy? Get started with a demo today at creatoriq.com.